Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes it feels counterintuitive, like the nightingale, a bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted that you could join me today. How's your week been so far? Have you managed to get out into the September sunshine and forage for some berry goodness? The berries are really coming into their own right now, like elderberry, hawthorn and rosehips. Yes, rosehips. When I was a child, you used to be able to buy rosehip syrup from the chemist. My mum gave it to me as a tonic, along with my vitamin C tablet and a fish oil capsule every day. And well, that's when I wasn't having to swallow a concoction called Scott's Emulsion, which was a vitamin-rich cod liver oil tonic that I was amazed to see is still made pretty much to the same formula today. But getting back to the rosehips, I'm determined to pick some and make my own rosehip syrup this year. There are whole hedgerows of beautiful rugosa roses near where I live, and the big red fruits are looking ripe and ready for picking. I've written about the value of rosehips on my website, thepracticalalchemist.uk, so check that out for more information. But one major use is as an anti-inflammatory, and these days you can reap the benefits of rosehips from all sorts of preparations, from tablets to tea. My guest today would know all about that. He's a herbalist, author, and the father of iridology, Peter Jackson Main. But you know, that does him a disservice because Peter is hugely knowledgeable about natural healing across the board. Currently, he's academic director, head of research, and course director for herbal medicine at the College of Naturopathic Medicine. Now, only the other day, I was struck by how some people still dismiss the notion of natural healing as woo-woo nonsense. But many practitioners have a strong science background, and Peter's no exception. A paragraph in his website bio at thenaturalcentre.com caught my eye, as I told him when we spoke. Peter, I was really curious about, when I read your about page, and you say you examined the nature of research itself and concluded that standard biomedical research models are ill-suited to assess complex interventions such as plant medicine and natural healing. Now, and you've worked extensively in the herbal and naturopathy world, and obviously, you know, you're very well known for iridology. So I just wanted to go from that point, because you did do science. So you're coming at it from somebody who is quite rigorous in their approach. This isn't woo-woo.
No, absolutely. I did a Master of Sciences degree in, it was in herbal medicine, but it was, you know, what you do at master's level is to really examine the foundations of the knowledge base, the epistemology, as we would call it.
Yeah.
I've been unhappy for some years that herbal medicine practitioners and natural medicine practitioners were being asked to evidence what they do according to criteria that are set by the standard medical profession. And those criteria are basically not only set by the standard medical profession, but they're also uniquely and clearly designed to test what ultimately are very simple interventions, which would be one molecule that we call a drug administered in response to a particular diagnosis. So in fact, you know, it's a very simple pathway: symptom, diagnosis, medication. And that medication is rare. It could be quite a complicated molecule, don't get me wrong, but it's just one molecule. When you add into the picture that in a plant we have possibly 100 or more molecules in one medicine, and then you look at what herbalists do, which is they combine herbs in a formula and give a very, very complex medicine, pharmacologists get very jittery about this. They call herbs dirty medicine because they bind to too many receptors and they're complete, you know, you can't figure out where they're going and what they're going to do, which is part of the magic.
Yeah.
as it turns out, from the way I explain it to students and to myself anyway, which is that a plant has an interaction with your system that's very, very complicated. It's like a conversation. It's a conversation in chemistry, in chemical terms. I often say to people that the plant chemicals are the lexicon, if you like, or the language of how plants communicate with our bodies. And it's a very, very complex language that we cannot possibly consciously take on. So there's that aspect to it. And then in terms of natural interventions, there's also the process of the consultation. I've read a lot of research on why, for example, people choose natural therapists rather than doctors sometimes to go and see. And one of the reasons, it turns out, is because, strangely enough, they get a lot more attention, and they get a better quality of attention from a complementary or we don't like that word, but a natural practitioner. So the quality of attention, and there's a lot of research about this in mainstream medicine. It's called the bedside manner, and it's about that quality of attention that the physician gives to the patient that helps in the healing process, is part of it. And if you're a naturopath, you're not only are you doing that and you're giving them perhaps a herbal remedy, you may be giving them supplements, you may be giving them homework in terms of, what to do about their diet, their exercise program, their hydration, et cetera, et cetera. So the complexity just expands. And the standard medical research model, which is sort of, kind of reduced to those three little letters, RCT, which stands, or it's a sort of a kind of a diminution of the term randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trials. So it's down to RCT. And that model, which is where they take a group of people, they split them randomly in half, they give one person the proper medicine, they give the other person, the other one group, the proper medicine, the other group, the placebo, and they compare how they do. And there are various sort of other sort of, kind of variations on that model, but that's basically what it is. And it's very good if you want to test the response to one particular medicine with a very narrow cohort of patients, i.e. one of the things they have to do is to exclude patients who might have other things going on. So if you're testing a headache medication, that headache can't have been caused by having a hangover. It can't be caused by having other kinds of pathologies in the picture. It must be a particular kind of headache and not any old headache or a migraine, for example. So that model of testing has been applied to herbal medicine and supplementation as well, but it doesn't work very well. We used to run at the College of Naturopathic Medicine, we used to run a final year dissertation project for students, for third year students. They had to write a literature review of clinical trials, and the conclusions of every single one of those papers was, cautiously optimistic, but lots more trials need to be done. How long do you have to carry on doing trials on medicine that has been proved by centuries of use? And that's the conclusion that we came to, was that, first of all, we seem to be in this culture at the moment where we have to test and retest everything. We can't take anything on trust anymore. You have to re-examine it perpetually in order to make sure it's scientifically verifiable. And a lot of the time it kind of isn't. If we're going to get onto iridology at some point, I can talk about it from that perspective as well, because in order to test something, you have to understand the qualities that pertain to that thing. You can't test something for doing something it's never supposed to do. And that's what's been done in both herbal medicine and iridology, is the right questions have not been asked in the research. Now, there are models of research called whole systems research, for example, which are very complex models, but they are set up to investigate what we call complex interventions. So complexity is built into the system at every level, and it's almost impossible to reduce it. And that's why I had to look very, very closely into this. I had to look at the history of science, the philosophy of science. I found out that what passes for science these days gave up its affiliation to any kind of philosophical underpinning at the beginning of the 20th century. People like Wittgenstein, the Vienna Circle, etc., sort of turned their backs on it and said, we don't need philosophy anymore because we've got science, and science is philosophy. And as one commentator put it, and I love this, science is an ideology which is distinguished by the fact that it believes it is not an ideology. Howard Waitzkin. And it's very, very circular. Scientists say this is the only evidence we can accept. Why? Because, well, this is the evidence we accept. You know, I'm sorry, but there are other kinds of evidence. There are other ways of examining things. We need to understand that. So, yeah, I did my master's on that. I did research on research. That's a little bit circular in itself.
I love that. Yeah, that's great. I do love that. And you're right about the bedside manner, but also a friend of mine and a friend of the show is a medical herbalist, and she's reporting that she's so much more busy now than she ever was because people can't get to see their doctors. But also you do get a much more thorough investigation into what might be going on with your system if you see somebody who's a herbalist, because they take everything into consideration. As you're saying, you know, it's not just one thing or one linear process. But it's just such a wonderfully diverse, it is a science, really, you know. We're talking about, it depends on how you define science, but we're talking about molecules, we're talking about chemicals, we're talking about all sorts of different things that interact, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. And science, you know, we should get away from this idea that science is just about things that happen in laboratories and controlled environments. There are natural sciences that don't depend on that at all. There are sciences like, I mean, very close to the investigation that I conducted is a social science called anthropology, the study of people. And the study of people and their medical systems in other countries where they don't do what we do, in particular, very, very, you know, clearly indigenous places like South America and various places in Africa, for example, where they do their own thing in the forests there, despite anybody else.
Yes.
And we find things, we find a very, very different environment in which people function and function successfully. In my own piece that I wrote, which has an impossibly long title that even I can't remember at the moment, about, you know, research and commensurability. And one of the points I bring forward is that any form of medicine is system specific or system dependent. If you have the right social structures to support it and the right beliefs, this system to report, we all know placebo works, therefore belief is a strong part of the equation, then it doesn't matter whether it objectively works. It works because that's what they do. And that's how they run their lives. And who is anybody to come in and say, no, that's rubbish. You know, one of the things that happened when scientists went into, pharmacologists particularly, are very keen on South American jungle because, you know, it yields, in their views, you know, so much material that's never been discovered. So the starting materials of drugs we can only begin to dream about. But in the process of doing it, they started to test this material in terms of the things that the shamans, the plant shamans and curanderos in those areas told them that it would do. You know, it would maybe sort out your period pains, or it would sort out your circulatory problems, etc. And they found they couldn't do it. And so they tried refining it and extracting it in different ways, and it still wouldn't work. And so eventually they went back to the shamans and they said, well, this medicine doesn't work. I don't know how you do it, but we can't get it to work. And the shaman said, well, did you talk to the plant? And it brings out, you know, I mean, you'll find amongst herbalists that they're very keen on talking to their plants. Mm-hmm. And why not? You know, we say that's a bit woo, you know, that's, you know, that's not science, but why not? Why can't it be science?
It is so interesting, isn't it? I have aloe plants, and sometimes if I need some help from my aloe plant, I will ask permission. I'll ask it if it's happy to give me a leaf so that I can put it on my skin and help heal whatever I want to heal. And thing is, you know, they do talk back. If you listen,
they do
talk to you. And I'd say this to people and they think I'm completely mad, but I don't, you know, I think it's just normal, right? Years ago, Prince Charles was laughed at for talking to plants, wasn't he? But nobody laughs at him now. He's king.
He trumped a lot, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. But also the belief element as well. It brings me back to Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Belief. When I read that years ago when it came out, I was, you know, throwing my hands up and shouting hallelujah, kind of, because here was somebody who actually recognized that aspect of well-being and healing. So that's part of it as well. And the entourage effect is kind of what we're talking about when we talk about all the different things that are going on with a plant medicine. And I say plant medicine not to be confused with what people are talking about when they talk about going down to the jungles of South America and taking hallucinogenics.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the herbal medicine. So it's important, isn't it? And I've spoken on the show before about certain herbs, certain plants that gave us certain drugs. The drugs that are extracted from the plant have side effects. If you just take the plant, you don't get the side effects.
Well, there's some very, very, very wonderful examples of that, actually. I mean, take the herb meadowsweet.
Yeah.
You know that one.
Mm-hmm.
Latin, Filipendula ulmaria. Well, it used in Latin before they reclassified it according to the new taxonomy based on DNA. They used to call it spirea, S-P-I-R-A-E-A. And it's a member of the rose family. Not many people know this, but the first distillation or extraction of acetyl salicylic acid, which of course is aspirin,
mm-hmm.
Was done from that plant, not from the willow bark. And it got its name from that plant, aspirin, you know, from spirea. And now we know that if we take aspirin in a badly managed way, it will destroy your stomach lining. So acetyl salicylic acid can be incredibly erosive or corrosive to the stomach lining. But it doesn't happen when you take meadowsweet, because meadowsweet also has chemical properties which protect the stomach lining. So we have that sort of very often a sort of duality within a herb of a chemical or a constituent, a phytochemical that could cause a problem if it were given in isolation, but it doesn't because of the buffering properties and the sort of balancing counteracting properties of the rest of the plant chemistry. So we get, in fact, from Filipendula the pain relief sometimes. I mean, I use it a lot for rheumatic pain and particularly joint pain, muscle pain. Very, very effective, I find it. So we get that aspect of it, which of course is what people look for in aspirin, pain killing, if you like. But we also get so much more, particularly in its effects in protecting the stomach, but also in many ways enabling the stomach and helping to regulate the digestion as well. So, you know, plants are very complex medicines, and it's one of the reasons why I really like them, and I never cease learning about them as well. I mean, you know, been in the business, well, I've been a herbalist for fully trained for more than 30 years now, and arguably, you know, involved with herbs before that, and there the plant kingdom continues to surprise and amaze me.
Well, it's so diverse. I can imagine. But before we go on to talk some more about the complexity of plants as medicine, it's time for us to take a short break. I'll be back with Peter Jackson Main for more after these messages from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ Stenhouse, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, Peter Jackson Main. Now, we were talking about the complexities of herbal medicines, and it struck me that if we would just lean into nature, we'd find all we need there. I think we forget, don't we, that we are part of nature, and we try to, or have done over the years, particularly in the last 100 years, we've tried to almost conquer nature and refine nature and think we're better than nature. But actually we're not. We are part of nature. We live in symbiosis with the natural world. And so it seems to me And, you know, I've probably said this many times on the show that living in line with nature is the way forward. It's not a retrograde step, as some people tend to think about herbal medicine.
Now, we mentioned our wonderful Majesty the King just now. This is a man I've met a couple of times, by the way, when he was the Prince of Wales, because he was very, very interested in natural medicine and in herbal medicine particularly. And of course, you know, his family are sort of long-term users of homeopathy as well. But when I met him, I joked with him, and he was, you know, he was courteous enough to laugh with me. And I said to him, there's that old adage, you know, where in the old days they would say, here, you know, you've got a problem, you've got a pain, eat this root. And then it would go to drink this decoction. And then it would go to take this pill. Then it would go to, you know, have this procedure. And I said, one day we'll be back to take this root.
Yeah.
And that's actually, you know, the truth of the matter is that the closer we get back to that, you're absolutely right. The closer we get back to nature, we cannot improve on nature, I don't think. We are nature. And within certain bounds, we can, you know, we can manipulate that. I mean, the making of brews and, you know, learning how to extract correctly from herbs, which is obviously one of the things we teach in herbal medicine, is very important, learning how to extract the medicinal properties of plants and other, you know, other substances as well, is a really important skill. But the minute we start to refine them down to their basic blocks and then take bits out of them and say, well, we'll have this, but throw the rest away, we start getting into trouble. There's one very interesting example of that, and that's the herb carver. I don't know whether you've heard of that.
Yes, I have, yeah.
It is illegal in this country now. It's been made PON, which means prescription-only medicine. They wouldn't even allow us to put it into the poisons category, which as herbalists we could use. It's called Schedule 20 now, because they said we don't want to expand that category because in itself it's problematic that we're giving you plants like deadly nightshade and, you know, and datura that you can, I can work with those plants if I want. I don't very much, to be honest with you. But I can if I want. And they didn't want to put anything else in that category. And the reason that it got banned was because it was implicated in, as many herbs are from time to time, when they want to put a question over something, they'll say, right, does liver damage? It gives you liver damage.
Mm. Maybe yeah, that's always a good one, yeah.
Yeah. And there may be one or two cases from the, you know, from adverse events that have been reported, particularly in Germany. And what we found out was that the reason for those poisonings was that people were extracting the carvalactones, which they thought were the business end of the plant. And in doing so, they were destroying a really important antioxidant called glutathione, which would protect the liver in a natural plant preparation. Because in it, you know, in the Polynesian islands, the South Pacific islands, where this plant is springs from and is well known, it's a sacred plant, actually it's a ritual plant, and they would never do a tincture or a high you know, high potency extract of it. They just boil it up like wood, you know, and they don't have any problems with it, of course. So the poisonings were taking place precisely because we're now extracting chemicals that could be a problem, delivering them as medicines, as pharmaceuticals really, and then expecting them not to be, you know, that we've somehow improved on the plant. We haven't. And it's a shame because carver is one of the best herbs for anxiety out there. You know, I know very, very few things that can compete with it on that level, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. You mentioned glutathione. Now, I am taking a glutathione supplement right now, which it's working really well, I have to say, delivered orally and through the skin, not in the stomach where it would be, you know, destroyed. Yeah. And I've been pondering whether, yes, sometimes it's useful to give your body a boost of something like that. It's an antioxidant. But in the end, what we really need to be doing is just reconnecting with all the things that our body needs on a daily basis and steering clear of things like ultra processed foods, of course. And then the herbal lexicon, if you like, is there to just tweak our systems when we need to and say, okay, let's get you back into balance. That's how I look at it. Is that how you look at it as well?
Yeah, you know, amongst herbalists, there are two camps, if I can put it that way, of those like myself who believe that the best health is achieved by taking some herbs every day. It doesn't even matter what, in my view. Okay, I'd say make sure you take some plants, and of course, we do plants foods as well. You know,
Yes.
the dividing line between plants and medicines in the natural world is very, very slim indeed.
Yeah.
And as Hippocrates said, let thy food be thy medicine, let thy medicine be thy food. And so there are those of us who believe that taking herbs, it almost stands in as well for the way that perhaps we used to live when we were hunter-gatherers and foragers, because we would just eat anything that was available at the time. And
Exactly,
my colleague, the herbalist Jill Davis, has in her book called Self Heal, points out that, you know, from coprophilic samples, you know, from coprolytic samples from the Stone Age, for example, they were eating something like 140, 150 different
yes.
species every year throughout the course of the year. And now we've got that down to about 20 or 30, which is ludicrous. And she says that herbal medicine stands in for that loss in a way that we get more plant material into ourselves by using herbal medicine. So for me, I use herbs every day. I might use them to help digestion. I check myself out. What do I need today? I'm lucky because I know about these things. And that's what I do for my patients as well. You know, they receive from me a bespoke medicine that suits them. It gets changed every so often according to need. And the most common comment coming back from my long-term patients or clients is that last prescription that suited me so well. Can I just go on with that for a while? And I say, yeah, no problem. Just let me know if you intuit that
Yes.
you need to change it at all, and we'll do that. So for me, and when I was working up in a very, very high profile clinic in the north of England, which I took over from a wonderful man called Charles Abbott, the place was called Abbots of Lee. When I took that over, he'd been dead for 15 years. His patients were coming in to collect the prescriptions that he'd last written for them. And when I came in, there was a huge excitement because I was another herbalist in Abbots. I was very, very lucky to get that gig, actually. And they all came flooding. The first day I was there, I had 20 patients.
Wow.
And the most number of patients I saw in a day was 46. And that was, you know, that was the
What?
way the place was set up.
Gosh.
And I would occasionally say, being the way I was taught, you know, well, you seem to be better. So, you know, just come back if there's something else comes up. And they say, oh, no, it's coming to see you and taking your herbs that keeps me well. And you're reminded of the old Chinese thing about, you know, the acupuncturist that they didn't, you know, he would not get paid if they got sick. They paid him to keep them well. And it's very much on that level with me. There are people, however, in the herbal world who feel that herbs are medicines and should only be given when you're sick. And my response to that is, well, okay, but where is the dividing line between being sick and being well? Because you can be well one day and you can wake up the next day and not be so well. So what's going on there? You know, health is a very fluid situation in my book. It's constantly open to change. It's open to change on the emotional level too. Everybody knows that suddenly an old trouble can come back when you get under stress, for example. So at what point do you not need medicine? I'm not clear about that. And so to cover my back, so to speak, or to cover all eventualities, I just take herbs every day.
Well, I think you've just really clarified something in my mind for me there. So yes, I absolutely get what you're saying. And of course, a lot of people are deficient, as we've said. You know, we're not getting the number of plants into our body. We're not getting the diversity into our body. And CBD is an example, isn't it? You know, in the past, there was a lot of hemp grown and we used to feed it to animals and then, you know, and we would then consume those and we'd get some CBD into our systems. And nobody gets that anymore naturally, especially if you're doing it, if you're on a an ultra processed diet of crisps and you know, all kinds of junk food. But yeah, so it's something that I've personally been sort of wondering about in my own life. You know, you start taking something because your body really feels it needs it, and then you stop and you think, well, shouldn't I still be taking that? Because have I not just gone back to where I was before? Maybe, unless I make other changes. It's fascinating. So I completely get what you're saying there. Yeah.
I think it's important to put into the mix there that you know, the word cure, which we're not supposed to use. If you use the word cure on a website or something, the ASA will
absolutely
down.
Yeah.
Imprison you and, you know, ostracize you forever. But I do use the word cure without apology, because sometimes I've seen cures happen when they're approached properly.
Mm.
You're using a herb to mask a symptom, not, as you say, doing the homework, doing the legwork to get yourself better as well, then you will not get a cure. You will get, you know, as soon as you stop taking the herb, it'll come back. I'll give you an example. You talked about aloe vera, which I love, because I've got a great story about aloe vera. You know, the probably shouldn't mention the name of the company.
No, don't. Maybe,
but a very famous company producing aloe vera products sent me, because they see me on a list of herbalists, sent me a rep one day, turned up completely unexpected and unannounced, knocked on my door, fortunately I was in, and said, can I interest you in these products? And I looked at them, it was all aloe vera, and I said, oh, that's interesting. And I said to him, as he talked, he listened to him, I thought, this is a guy who probably has never met an aloe vera plant. So I asked him, I said, have you ever seen one live? And he said, no, actually I haven't. And I said, well, come in, because by the merest chance, in the back room in our house, I had 20 of them. Because I'd cleared out a herbalist colleague of mine who's moved out of her premises and moved back to the United States where she came from, had asked me to take on these plants. So I took them on. So I had, the floor was just covered with a carpet of aloe vera plants. And I opened the door and he just about fell backwards in astonishment. And he said, that's aloe vera. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, I can see that I'm carrying coals to Newcastle here. Mm-hmm. Then. And I said, yes. And but I engaged him in a particular conversation as well, because I said, well, you know, in your understanding, what does aloe vera do? Well, he said, for example, it's very, very good for irritable bowel syndrome. And he's quoted me all of these studies that demonstrated that people with IBS would benefit from aloe vera. And I said, that's really interesting. I know about that use of aloe vera, obviously. And I have other uses for it, by the way. But tell me this, when they stopped taking the aloe vera, what happened?
Mm.
And he said, well, they all got their IBS back again. And I said, well, that's not a cure. So for me, a herb that will take away a symptom is not necessarily the right thing to be doing. It can help, can help to make the body more comfortable temporarily while you get on with the real healing work that needs to happen. But you need to watch that very, very carefully. So when I talk about taking herbs every day, I don't necessarily mean, oh, you know, I'll take a herb for a headache today, or I'll take a herb for, you know, for a tummy ache today. You know, I mean, what is your body calling for?
Mm.
And you have to sort of get into the herbal world. You know, this is what I do as a practitioner. I function. I stand in for your own intuition for a few months. And then I get you used to working with herbs, and then you can start making your own choices.
Ah, yes. And how often have I said we should just tune in and listen to our bodies? Well, we'll have more from Peter Jackson Main in a minute or so. But first, it's time for a short break to hear these messages from our station sponsors.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station, with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest, Peter Jackson Main. I'm loving Peter's description of how he works and how we might approach working with herbs ourselves as a normal part of our lives. It takes me back to what I was saying about, you know, taking something for a while and then stopping it. Has it really done what it needs to do? Or should you just carry on because you know it's helping you and you know it works? So another thing that I take at the moment is a very good gut supplement. And my gut flora had been wrecked from childhood, from birth, actually, and come through the whole of my life periodically having issues with my gut, and it manifested in having a problem with histamine. So I wasn't, you know, dealing with histamine in my body at all. And I started taking the supplement, and I was taking my one a day yesterday even, and I was thinking, so do I carry on taking this, or is this, has this now rectified 50 years or more worth of histamine issues? And of course I thought, no, just take it, you know, because there is this resistance in me, and I think a lot of other people, to taking a thing every day. Yeah. You know, do I really need to take something every day? Am I really so deficient? Am I really so not quite perfect that I need to take something, a supplement?
Yeah.
But
that's an interesting expression, isn't it? There's something wrong with me.
Yeah. So there is that mental thing as well, that psychological aspect to it as well. You know, do I really need to be doing this constantly?
You know what I find with patients, that very often, at a certain point, they forget, they start forgetting to take their medicine.
That is true
too. They come back to me and they say, oh, I'm so sorry, I haven't been very good this month. And I say, what happened? They said, well, I just found myself missing doses and I've only finished half the bottle. I said, that's fine. That shows me that your body's now saying, probably enough. Yeah. So your question, should I carry on taking this? Very often we try and sort these things out intellectually, but you get a better answer if you ask the body.
Yeah.
So if you know how to listen to your own body, very often it will give you the answers that it needs. And that's why I think that developing intuition alongside this process is really, really important. We've lost the ability to self-regulate as people. And so we rely on people like me. I can't complain. I'm making a good living out of it. But my ideal, like my illustrious teacher, Dr. Richard Schultz, who used to say, you know, my idea behind natural healing is that we give everybody the means of self-regulating healthcare, and then we can all just go down to the beach and party together.
Very good idea,
and
yeah.
It is kind of very, you know, it's very attractive that we can create a society of people who are largely self-regulating. And again, Dr. Schultz and to some extent myself also were taught in Dr. Christopher's School of Herbal Medicine called the School of Natural Healing. And Dr. Christopher used to say, we need a herbalist in every home, somebody who knows this stuff in your family who can advise, and a practitioner in every community, i.e. somebody who knows a bit more who can help you, you know, if you have deeper questions. And that's a very good structure for a healthcare network, I think, that doesn't depend on handing your power wholesale to science or what passes for science.
I love that idea. I love that idea. And I am usually very good at, you know, if I start forgetting to take something, I'll go, okay, well, I must be okay now then. That's fine. You know, move on.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting how just yesterday I was having this mental, you know, to and fro, should I, shouldn't I, do I not, you know, oh yeah, just carry on. But I actually do know intuitively, I will know if I need to stop.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it'll happen. I'll just stop. I'll forget to take them and I'll know I'm done.
Yeah.
But yeah, so many of us though have lost that connection. I mean, how do you get that back? Is there a way that, I mean, do you help people find or rediscover that connection to their systems and their bodies?
I try to. It's very individual because not everybody's kind of, you know, we're not all on the same page where those sort of things are concerned. And some people have very much been educated into that, you know, pill for an ill kind of mentality. You know, I'm ill, so I have to take medicine. And, you know, I'll have to take it for the rest of my life. Because actually, if you go to the doctor, even with something fairly simple like high blood pressure, you get put on blood pressure meds. There's no way when you ask the doctor, oh, how long will I be on these? And the doctor will look back at you as though you're crazy and say, well, you'll always have to take them because you've got high blood pressure. I had a diabetic patient. He said he went back. I was helping him with herbs. He was on metformin, which is an anti-diabetic medication. I was helping with herbs. The metformin wasn't working. The herbs worked. They brought his blood sugars back into the normal realm. He went to his doctor and said, well, I'm normal now, so I don't need this metformin. The doctor said, well, yeah, you'll always need the metformin because you're a diabetic. And he said, well, what's the definition of diabetes? Blood sugar over a certain level. But I haven't got that. So how am I a diabetic, you know? But the doctors were, oh, no, it doesn't matter. You'll always be a diabetic. Once a diabetic, always a diabetic. Once a hypertensive, always a hypertensive. And they don't admit the possibility. You know, we've thrown the word cure out because they can't do it. They don't admit that it that it exists. So sometimes you have to educate people back into the belief that they can be well. And that might take different amounts of time with different people. Some people never get there. They just don't really resonate with that. The best patients resonate with it, and they kind of really take it on, and I love nothing more. I'm teaching students, for example. I find a lot of them might consult myself and other herbalists at the start of their journey. By the time they get out, they're doing it for themselves. And I think that's, you know, that's really something to aim for.
Well, that is fantastic. And you know, before we finish this conversation, which I've been thoroughly enjoying, we need to talk about iridology and where that sits in all of this. Well, maybe we need to do another.
You need another hour, JJ. Okay, so very, very simply, iridology is a, we call it a diagnostic tool. It's not diagnosis in the way people would imagine it. So I don't look in your eyes and say, oh, you've got high blood pressure today.
Yeah.
You've got this or that or the other. And if you do that, you can cause alarm. So we don't do that. What we do is we use it. The iris of the eye is a very, very individualized pattern. We know this because it's used as bioidentification at passport control and other facilities that, you know, as an identifier of who you are. And it's about 10 times more effective or more accurate than your fingerprint, by the way. So it's much sought after in those levels. So as a unique individual identifier, it is an image, if you like, that describes what we call constitution, your natal constitution, what you were born with, and to some extent what might have happened to it downlined. So yeah. It goes right back to traditional medicine like Ayurveda, for example, where they have the notion of Prakriti and Vikriti. Prakriti is natal constitution. Vikriti is what happens to it as you go through life, and it changes. And we have the same concepts. The eyes don't necessarily change that much themselves. That's a very important thing to bear in mind. This is partly what my second book, my first book, Practical Iridology, is, as it says, is a guide to using iridology to understand your constitution. My second book goes much, much more deeply into the energetics and the sort of deeper significance of the iris. And the iris really is, you know, it can give you an awful lot of information, certainly about your physical organs, their resistance, resilience, you know, your whether you have tendencies towards diseases of one sort or another, because very often you look in the eyes, you can't say you've got diabetes, but you could say, oh, has there been a family history of diabetes here? Or do you occasionally get hypoglycemic, get hangry, you know, angry when hungry, experience any signs of fluctuating blood sugar? And we can use it on that level to divine or to uncover, to reveal familial and constitutional tendencies towards certain conditions. And then, of course, you know, give the right advice to rectify them as well. And the wonderful thing about iridology is that it's not necessarily stuck on what the patient came in saying was wrong with them. You might unearth a few things that underpin that. So somebody might come in with headaches, and you know, the standard response is find something that's, I don't know, painkiller, antispasmodic or whatever, and the iridology will say, well, this headache's actually coming from the digestive tract, or specifically the liver.
Yes. Yeah.
Something like that. So you can sort of get to the underlying dynamics of the surface symptoms with this method, I find. There's a lot more I could say about
that. Yeah, no, I know. You must come back again, and we must talk in more depth about that. But it's been fabulous talking with you today. Now, you have a practice, and do tell us where people can get in touch with you. And obviously you can buy your books online in the usual places, I'm guessing, and also
Practical Iridology got sold to an American publisher and is no longer available in this country except through me. You can buy it through my website, which, by the way, can I say?
Yes, do say. Yeah, please.
HTP, whatever it is, thenaturalcenter.com. If you just put thenaturalcenter.com into your search window, then you will find it. We're the only naturalcenter.com, myself and my partner. And there is a shop attached to that. We don't sell very much because we don't sell our herbal medicines that way. Fully legal, but we do sell the book and my iris chart, my iridology chart, which you can buy. Now, I'll just say that the Practical Iridology is being republished this November in an expanded revised edition by Aeon Books. And although you're welcome to buy a copy of the older book, I've got a few left. Personally, I would wait for the new one. And I'll be at the, also, if you want to see me in London, without necessarily booking a session. I'm going to be at the Mind Body
Oh, are you?
Soul Festival, the Wellbeing Festival at Alexandra Palace.
Yeah.
You can hook up with me there.
When's that?
It's mid-October.
Yeah, okay.
I don't carry dates in my head. I have a diary for that.
Yeah, me too.
But sometime around that time, second weekend in October, I think.
Okay.
I'd be very happy to see anybody there if you want to drop by and have a word with me. And of course, I do consult as well. I consult online. Very difficult to do iridology online, but sometimes we can manage it. People can get good enough pictures. But certainly I do herbal medicine and naturopathic consultations online, and they're rather easier to get than my in-person appearances, which happen in central London approximately every other Thursday now.
Right. Oh, so you're not in London that often these days.
Yeah. Well, I am there quite often because I also teach there. But
doing the consult, yeah.
I do 2 days a month. That's it, yeah.
Well, fantastic. And I think we're going to have to wrap it up here, although I could talk to you all day. Please come back and talk some more about iridology and a whole load of other things. We had a great conversation even before we started to record this. So, you know, I'd love you to come back another time. But for now, Peter Jackson Main, thank you so, so much. It's been a really insightful conversation today. So thank you very, very much indeed for that.
Well, thank you, and it's my pleasure.
And I really do hope that Peter will join me again to talk more about iridology for a start and all things natural health. But for now, that's pretty much it for today. Do check out Peter's website, thenaturalcentre.com, and mine, thepracticalalchemist.uk. And while you're there, do subscribe to my newsletter to be the first to get some great content right in your inbox. Or find me as The Practical Alchemist on Instagram and Facebook and say hello there. Remember, you can listen to all our shows on all the main podcast platforms these days. And if you like what you hear, or if they've helped you, do help us spread the word by sharing them. Also, please check out the show I co-host with psychiatrist and coach Dr. Mark Goulston here on UK Health Radio. It's called Hurt Less, Live More. And Mark and I share great experiences, anecdotes and wisdom with some great guests. And I usually get what amounts to a free therapy session to boot. But thank you for listening today. I hope you'll join me here again on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast. Until that time, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.